This episode of the Coastal Noise podcast was done entirely on an airplane where I met Levy Wall, who just happened to be sitting next to me, and he is a architect slash designer for the city of Fort Collins. He's a native to Colorado, and we just kind of started talking sitting on the airplane, and I asked him if he'd be interested in doing an interview, and he said yes. So it helped the time pass for sure, and as always, you know, the importance of traveling to a place is always meeting the people as well. So I was really happy that he would agree to have a chat with me. So also, it should be noted that we, of course, didn't have the usual equipment that we use for the show with mics and everything. So this is all entirely recorded off of an MP3 player that I had. And so I also had to do some edits where, you know, people came on the loudspeaker and it was really difficult to hear. So I tried to do as best as I could to make it bearable to listen to. So I hope you give it a listen to. I know the audio is probably not the best, but the conversation's good nonetheless. CoastalNoise.com for all the other podcasts. You can follow me on Facebook or Twitter, and the same with the Coastal Noise. And hopefully I'll have another blog up soon that details some of my trip to Colorado a little bit more, along with some pictures.
But I haven't ever been to California. It's one of the places I want to go a lot, and I have some family friends who live in San Diego, and but I've also heard tons of stuff about San Francisco. Yeah. The things I hear about San Francisco is they're one of the most intellectually, they're smart people.
Yeah,
and
I can see that.
You know, and it's a very clean city. And no, not so much.
I don't know. It wasn't the cleanest city I've ever been. There's a lot of like homeless people and stuff too. But I mean, it's beautiful though. I wouldn't say it's not clean. It's just like not the cleanest city I've been to. But I don't know. Depends on what part you're in, probably too.
Yeah. Well, you get that with a lot of cities.
Yeah.
For sure. The reason I went to Portland, Oregon, is I went to a 3-day conference for business management of running isolation tank centers.
Really?
Have you ever, I think y'all have some in Denver.
Yeah, probably.
Have you ever heard of them?
Yeah, I don't know, you should explain it. So, I think I sort of know what it is, but.
They're these tanks that this neuropsychologist invented back in the 60s, John C. Lilly, and they're these tanks, and the original designs were about 8 feet long by 4 feet wide, 4 feet high, and you lay in them. There's 10 inches of water. It's got 800 pounds of Epsom salt so that you float in it, and the water's kept at skin temperature, so it's like about 97 degrees or so. And you lay in this thing, and the salt makes you float. It's very buoyant, so you lay on your back in total darkness, close the hatch. It's soundproof, it's lightproof. The water where it comes up to your skin, the air and the water temperature are both, you know, skin temperature.
Yes, you don't feel it.
Right, so you don't feel anything. So it's complete sensory deprivation is the goal of it. So he invented it just to kind of study the brain, and then he got into it and started having hallucinations. You have visual changes because when so much of your sensory input just doesn't have to, because your brain's processing, like, you know, most of it's like 90% of everything that's going on is through your sensory input. So when you shut all that stuff off, you know, you don't feel anything, you don't hear anything, you don't see anything. Your brain just eventually kind of like goes on vacation, and your brain waves jump from alpha waves that go all the way up to theta waves, which have been associated to like high levels of deep sleep. And like when monks become very skilled in the art of meditation, they, you know, they go to these high levels of brainwave functioning, and your body releases natural endorphins, which are the body's painkillers. So it's a great stress reliever for you. Your body not having to fight against gravity, your spine kind of elongates, your muscles elongate. So it's huge for athletes and people training, like tons of Olympic athletes use them. You know, you lay in them for like an hour. Like that's like the bare minimum.
Really? But so it takes a while for the.
Yeah, it takes a while because your brain, you know, you kind of have to stop thinking for a little bit. I've only been in them twice, once in Portland and then once in Atlanta. And they were big for a while, like once the 70s took off. And I think the first major producer was from San Francisco, I want to say. And that was Samadhi. And they were the first people to produce for John C. Lilly. You know, he started realizing, hey, these things are badass. And he needed a company to produce them on a large scale. So this company started producing them for his research. And then they started realizing that it had commercial applications. So they had, you know, centers in San Francisco that had 13 of these tanks.
Oh, wow.
But then things got a little hairy because people started having the AIDS scare occurred, and people thought that AIDS could be transmitted through water, which is totally not true. Doesn't work that way. And then people had issues of cleanliness and all this stuff. But of course, the salt kills tons because it's a natural antiseptic itself.
Yeah, it's gonna be pretty.
Yeah, plus the waters were. Plus you filter it out. It's
like a pool, but
right.
Yeah, probably more
it's
clean.
Cleaner. It's cleaner than pools and hot tubs and a lot of bathtubs too. Because I mean, you don't usually clean your bathtub every use. So this stuff runs on a filter, you know. So me and a cousin were thinking about opening one down where we live, because the nearest one is Atlanta. Or no. It's a place just outside of Atlanta called Athens.
Oh yeah.
It's a 6-hour or. No, that's not right either. It's not Athens. It's not Atlanta. Who knows what the hell it's called?
But it's somewhere in Georgia.
Yeah, somewhere in Georgia. But we, and of course, like I talk to anybody about isolation tanks where I'm from, and like 1 in 15 people know what it is, and it's like the randomest person that you find. So I thought I was like the only person who knew about these things, and I got really fascinated with them and started researching them. Wanted one really bad, but they're like cars. They cost, if you want to buy an isolation tank, be able to like buy that instead of a car, if that's what you're
going to do.
Yeah,
are they sort of like $20,000 to $30,000?
Yeah, they can, especially European ones that are really nice. It's pretty big in Europe, like in London and some places. Some places in Europe, like I think the UK, is like every couple miles they have these things. They have centers for these. The biggest one is a company called Floatwork. Float Lab? Something like that.
So how much does it like, cost to do an hour session in one of these?
Typically an hour is like $60 or something like that. Portland, they had the conference, the people that were holding the conference was a company called Float On, and we went there, and they do 90 minutes for, I think, $50. So it's a pretty good deal there. And so it's kind of cool because Portland is like really hip to it. Like a lot of places are starting to open up with centers, and apparently like the more centers open, it like there's not much of a competition drive, because when people open up, it kind of educates more people, so everybody gets a boost in their sales and their business and all this stuff. But it's really cool because the people there, since they're so hip to it, a lot of people are trying to reinvent it, and they're inventing vertical. There's one guy who's been inventing a vertical tank where you put weights on your ankles and you wear like a scuba mask kind of thing. Or no, you don't even do that. You
just float floats right up.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, and you and he says the visual effects are way more prominent that way. The two times I've been in, the first time, so I'll go back to how we got started with all this. It's like me and my cousin, we were just talking about it, and somehow I was hanging eggs getting brought up, and it turns out my cousin Anthony knows just as much as me about isolation tanks. So we're literally standing up. We're both standing up to like see me off as I walk out the door, and we end up standing in his living room for 2 hours talking about isolation tanks. And in that 2 hours, we decide that we could maybe possibly open a business with these things. So, but we decide first we need a float in them. So we find out the closest two are Dallas, Texas, and in Georgia. so we're like, well, we got to try them out. So we drive one weekend, 6-hour drive to Georgia to the float center, float for 2 hours, and then drive straight back for another 6 hours. And first experience was pretty cool. You know, they say you have to kind of like do it 2 or 3 times before you really sink into it and you really get a feel for the tank, I guess you could say. But I did have a couple, few seconds in that first experience where I had like a moment of disconnect. And the way I describe it to people is it's like that moment when you're laying in bed and you're about to drift asleep and you almost like start dreaming, you almost start seeing something, and then you like jump, like almost like you're falling, you know, you realize. And I had this moment where after a couple seconds where I opened my eyes, because it was totally dark when I had my eyes closed, I opened my eyes and it's still completely dark and I don't feel anything and I don't hear anything and I totally forget where I am for a second, and it causes me to like kind of jolt, you know, like you're falling out of your bed and you kind of, you know, you jump. And then I realized where I was and I relaxed and all this kind of stuff. So that was my first experience. My second experience was not as great for my, the temperature, the place didn't have the air temperature very well, so I, like, my upper body was cold a little bit, so I had to like get up and tell him to kick on the heater, and then I stupidly rubbed my eye, got salt in my face, and so I had to get out and shower that out, and by the time it was over, you know, I just hadn't sunk into it. Meanwhile, my cousin, who was with me for this trip as well, had a more incredible experience than the first time, and you could tell he was high, because, you know, all the endorphins and were kicking, and it's like, you know, it's like the world just kind of shifts down, you know, everything's just very mellow and chill, and, you know, that feeling lasts with you for a couple hours after the experience, so it's just a fascinating thing.
Yeah, especially for somebody studying psychology.
Right, right. And there was one guy at this conference who discovered out how to lucid dream using isolation tapes.
Oh, really?
Tapes.
Yeah, better be conducive to that.
Yeah. He said that what he would do, he figured out that if he would sleep for like 6 hours, you have to set a regular sleep schedule, and then he would wake up at like the 6-hour mark, right when he was in REM sleep, you know, his deepest part, he would set an alarm. He'd wake up and he'd walk into his float room in his house, which is badass. if you've got a float tank in your room, you are making it in life. And he goes into his room and he gets in the tank and he says, you'll fall right back into REM sleep. And he says something about that combination of floating and going into REM sleep sends him into a state of lucid dreaming.
Wow.
And if that's true and if that's replicable for other people, the implications are pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Because I've only lucid dreamed a couple times in my life.
Service in the main cabin will begin shortly. In addition, a complimentary beverages, beer, wine, cocktail.
It's like your mom just running into the room and like, you want some Hot Pockets? Go away, Mom. We're trying to talk right now.
Doing a podcast, Mom.
I only stopped because I've listened to other podcasts that have done stuff on planes. It's like, let's kill time and do a podcast. Whenever it comes on, it's like, you just have to.
October is American Cancer Society's National Breast Cancer Awareness.
They're gonna do advertising now.
Please partner with Making Strides.
I can edit this out later.
Get in the BP experience with a refreshing glass of pink lemonade at today's flight. You can also join the fight by making a donation using our debit or credit card. Ask the flight attendant for details. For more information, you may access the American Cancer Society's website, cancer.org, free of charge using the GoGo Insight Internet.
Word.
So I had a friend, like, because I've only lucid dreamed maybe once or twice in my life too. I had a friend who, like, she she would always lucid dream, but she didn't realize that normal people don't usually lucid dream, and that's all. She always lucid dreams. She's always just goes, like, directly from waking, like, into dreaming, and, like, she's totally conscious and has total control. And she didn't realize that that wasn't normal. Like, and I was telling her, it's like, no, that's, like, a special kind of dreaming. Like, but I wonder, like, what makes people able to do that just, you know, regularly, and what makes other, you know, most people not able to do that. I don't know.
That's nuts. You would think that she would be, like, taking sleeping pills. Like, she'd always just be trying to go to sleep.
Yeah. No, I don't know what it was, but, yeah. And she totally, I mean, we're in college at this point. She totally didn't realize that was not normal for people to be able to control their dreams and be conscious of their dream state.
I guess that is, like, that would be, if that was just normal to you, that would be, like, an abnormal thing to convey with somebody, you know?
Right.
Because everybody else is always talking about how awesome their dreams are. And
yeah.
Really cool. But, you know, to just assume that everybody's controlling their dreams, that's wild. Because I've only done it a couple times, and but one time, maybe about 6 months ago, I had this night where I had a lucid dream, and then I woke up, and I was like, I just had a lucid dream. I went back to sleep, and like continued the lucid dream, and in that second dream, it was like I was figuring out the physics of the dream world, of the dream universe, and I started doing more things, you know? It was like the first dream, I discovered what was going on. The second dream, I started playing around with it, you know? And I started manifesting things with my consciousness and doing what, you know? And then, and it was weird because at one point, I realized that there was a property of the dream that I had to control to have more control into the dream. So then I woke up from that one and I was like, this is getting crazy. It's like, I'm just gonna try to go back to sleep. I'm just gonna try to keep going with it. And I went back to sleep and it was like, I just went right back into it.
Really?
And I just kept going and I got more and more crazy. And by the time I got around to the third dream, it was just guilty pleasures. I won't even talk about what I did in my third dream, but you know, it was total vanilla sky. It was just nuts.
Well, here you can, like, teach yourself to, supposedly, to lucid dream. You just have to, like, I guess practice awareness or something in real life, right?
And then there's tricks, like, if in your waking life, if you, like, constantly, like, look at your hands a bunch, then when you're in your dream, if you look at your hands and then realize you have talons or something like that, then you're like, hey, something's up. And you can train yourself, or, like, another thing is, like, I think I heard someone who, like, takes their finger and, like, pokes it into their mouth or something like that, and if they're, like, if they dreamed and they did it and their finger went, like, through their mouth or something like that, they were like, okay, well, that's not normal. But there are also devices that I've seen on the internet where you can, they're like these goggles, and it registers, I guess it monitors your brain waves, and it can tell when you're going into deep sleep, and it'll send little pulses of flashing light when you get into that deep sleep. So, like, if we were dreaming right now, all of a sudden, you know, if I saw, like, a bunch of lights, that would be my signal. It's like, oh, I'm dreaming. And then I would just work on the lucid dreaming thing. So that's pretty cool. I don't know. I never see people talking about stuff like that, you know? I would think there would be somebody, which, then again, like, dreaming's kind of a very personal thing, so I'm sure not a lot of people, you know, even if they had one of those things, that'd be something, like, I wouldn't be, like, running around at parties with and be like, you know, telling everybody about, because there's got to be something, a huge benefit to controlling your dreams, you know?
Yeah.
There's got to be, like, a stress-relieving element to it, or, you know, it's got to make you more creative, perhaps, you know?
Yeah.
If we could, like, imagine if Michelangelo could lucid dream all the time, and his inventions and his art were just, like, that much more incredible, you know?
Yeah.
What if everybody could start doing that, you know? If it was a major form of therapy.
Right. Well, it's almost like, it's like a form of play, which, you know, for children, of course, is a way of, like, you know, working through, like, real-life situations and stuff. And I mean, I've had dreams, like, a couple of dreams that like, I'll have a dream and it won't necessarily relate one-to-one to real life, but then it'll somehow resolve something in my consciousness about something in real life. And I don't know. So, yeah, maybe if you can control your dream, somehow it'd help you, like, play act or somehow, I don't know, determine things in real life that you couldn't otherwise.
Corporate businessmen are listening right now and going, if we can figure out how to control the market of lucid dreaming, we'll have the world. We'll make millions. But no, if you could do that, that would be something truly incredible. And I think if isolation tanks could be combined with that, then it would be that much more incredible. I would love to get a hold of one of those devices. I'm sure they're probably not very expensive, you know, with
the light pulsing devices?
Yeah. Because when I looked them up, I think they were like $150, and I researched these things like 2 years ago or something like that. So they're probably pretty cheap now. I mean, there's a lot of things out there that are, you know, with developing technology that are using more and more sensory registry toys, in fact. You know, I've seen, when I was at USM, I told this story recently about, you know, in Star Wars, the ball in the episode, the first original Star Wars, where Luke's in the Millennium Falcon, he's got his lightsaber, and the thing's flying around. Well, my friends found this thing that, it was the ball, but it was in a tube, and you put on this thing, this headpiece, and you have to think to make the ball levitate.
Interesting.
We would take turns, and like, some people would make it levitate more for longer periods. Some people couldn't get it up at all. Some people could hold it up for a couple seconds. I got it up for like a minute. Like, I held the record.
Like, is there something that connects to your head or something?
It goes to your head. But as far as like what you have to really think to make it do, you know, I just focused and I just concentrate. I don't really have like a set thought or anything like that I try to get through. I meditate sometimes. I got into Buddhism when I was in college and Eastern religions and all this stuff. My minor was actually a mix between religion and philosophy. And I took a lot of Eastern religions and started practicing on my own. Plus, college was terribly stressful.
So, yes, it's good to have some time.
And it was just something that I thought was really cool. Like, even as a kid, like, I always thought there was something really cool about a person just sitting half lotus style, you know, very composed and very concentrated, very focused. And, you know, you hear a monk talk and they're very just like in the moment, in the flow with it. So I thought there's got to be something to that, you know, and the fact that our American culture, you don't see that a lot. It has to be something as part of a conscious evolution that that is so what makes Eastern cultures so more mature, I guess you could say. And so I started getting into it, and I don't know, maybe that was a factor in how I held the Star Wars ball in space. maybe that was a factor. So I don't know, but with toys like that just being more prominent, I think that, you know, things like those lucid dreaming devices may become cheaper, and people might be able to have more access.
So do you think because a lot of those Eastern religions are very ancient, and really, well, I don't know if Western culture is necessarily winning in the world, but it's certainly having maybe more of an influence on the East than the East is having on it. Like, do you think there's some sort of de-evolution that's going on as far as consciously or otherwise?
I think that the only reason that America is putting more of an imprint on Eastern than Eastern is putting on us is because we have shot up as a culture. We found the new world. We killed the inhabitants. I was listening to a podcast today all about how Christopher Columbus came over. And like, so many people don't even get off for school anymore for Christopher Columbus Day. I don't think we really should, because he was brutal. He went over there and, I mean, he got there and he was like, I think one of the first letters he sent back was like, hey, I think we found some slaves.
Oh, really?
It was like one of his first messages back. And then he was like, all right, all you people bring me gold. And of course, like, a lot of the people in America, in the Americans, they didn't have gold. It wasn't until like the conquistadors went down to like South America. That's where all the gold was, the Aztec and all this stuff. So meanwhile, Christopher Columbus is in North America, like, bring me gold. And when the Native Americans didn't bring back anything. He would just, like, cut their arms off. And the more people would just, like, scatter to go find gold, you know? Meanwhile, they think he's a god. They think all his white men are gods and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, they just get easily manipulated and all this kind of things.
And then all the disease they inadvertently brought over, but still,
Yeah, guns, germs, and steel, you know?
Yeah.
They came over and just... People weren't prepared for that. And, you know, they brought over their religion, you know, try to conform everybody to Christianity and all these kinds of things. Meanwhile, they had a set life. They had been living for centuries, you know. And I think that, you know, that was the start. That was the first step for our country. And then we became a superpower, you know, probably a lot by luck. And then we started, you know, being producers and importers, and then it became the American dream. Everybody wanted to be an American.
Yeah.
So our technology exploded. We won a lot of lucky wars. We became a superpower, and we're still the superpower, but we're also kind of paying the price, I think, for our greed, for our arrogance. I think that I've used the analogy that our country is in its teenager phase, you know? We're very young, and we're very strong, we're very youthful, but at the same time, we're very stomping our feet, demanding things, and we think, as a culture, we know, you know, like most teenagers, we know how the world should be run, we know what we want, when we want it now, and just the fact that we have reality TVs and, you know, just our advertising, you know, we're very materialistic.
Yeah.
Versus spiritual.
For sure.
Thing, you know? And I think our religion is also very tied into our political system. I think it's easier to get people to go to war when you have a spiritual backing in place. I mean, one nation under God, we are a Christian religion, and you have so many presidents who make these speeches where, you know, we have to go to war with these people because they want to destroy our way of life. They want to, you know, take away our religion and kill our God and all this kind of stuff. Meanwhile, the people on the other side of the fence, over on the other side, are saying the same damn thing.
Yeah, saying something similar.
Same thing, you know, but, and then we have our media who shows us images of radical people in an uproar, and they're, you know, saying we got to watch out for these people. Well, this is why we have to go to war. These people
are holding. Right, it's like a fear-based thing. Yeah, right. Very fear-based. Yeah. Right.
Meanwhile, we're sending over drones, killing innocent kids, and stealing, you know, all their resources and their oil and opium. Like, Afghanistan's a major place for opium fields. And the government is the biggest drug dealer ever, I think. You know, I have a friend, Eddie Garabor, who's in the military, and he has stories of platoons that would go over and they'd find these huge opium fields full of heroin. They would go in and they'd kill all the drug dealers, saying, this is part of the war on drugs. They'd go in and they'd kill all the drug lords, and then turn around, you know, after they collected all the stuff, and then they would just turn their backs, they would leave, and then more people would go into the fields, other drug lords, and they'd re-harvest the field, grow it, and then they'd go in, back in and kill everybody again and then harvest again, you know?
Wow.
And that was the game, that's how they played it.
I'll have some apple juice.
Yeah, thank you. I actually also have apple juice.
It's the best flight beverage. I always get apple juice.
I had orange juice today, and I was on the field. I was on the fence about apple juice and orange juice, so I'm glad I can now make that decision.
That's good.
But I also recently found out, I did a blog recently on the website.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, man. I did a blog about, I was sick, and there was just a nasty bug that was going around, and I was sick for a while. So just to pass the time, I wrote a blog on, like, little advice on what I do to stay well and stuff like this. And I just did some research on what doctors, medical journals suggest, and other blogs and all this stuff, and just kind of compiled my own thing. And one of my things was drink orange juice. Very traditional, conventional thing for its vitamin C content. Well, the next day I did some follow-up research and was shocked when I found that my first Google cue about orange juice for sickness was all this stuff saying that it's a lie and really? It's propaganda and it's all marketing stuff. So I started doing research and found out that this guy, Pollan, Nobel Prize winner, and he wrote this book called Vitamin C and the Common Cold in the 70s, and it started this big trend with marketers that everybody just assumed, like, oh, vitamin C helps build your immune system. So all these marketers said, hey, orange juice has tons of vitamin C, tastes great, easy to produce, let's sell it. So that became a thing. But truthfully, vitamin C, they've done tons of studies where they give people groups of people, one group a vitamin C supplement every day, and another nothing, and it just did. They studied at time again, hasn't showed anything. Plus, not to mention that fruits, oranges for example, it has vitamin C. Also has a lot of sugar, a lot of fructose, or sugar in natural fruits. Yeah. But in our society, with all of our mass producing, it used to be in temporal regions, you would only have oranges and fruits at seasonal times, and then we'd have to supplement our diet with other things. Well, now we can grow that shit all the time. We can ship it anywhere. We have access to it all the time.
Right.
So, and when they produce it, there's lots of fructose that they add. So then that's bad for your health because more sugar means more fat, all this kind of stuff. So that's not a good thing. And then it also goes back to the fact that a lot of vegetables have more vitamin C than orange juice has. Kale, for example, has, like 100, I forgot the statistics, it's like oranges and like a cup of orange juice has like 81 milligrams of vitamin C, where chili peppers have the most of like anything. They have like 181 milligrams.
Oh, wow.
Then red peppers, yellow peppers, kale, broccoli, all of it have more vitamin C than oranges.
Interesting.
So, marketing, basically.
Well, I drink a lot of orange juice too, and I'm sick too, and I think it helps, but I know probably a lot of it is just staying extra hydrated. I mean, that always helps.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's not to say that vitamin C doesn't play a role in it at all. I mean, you have to have vitamin C, but it's usually people who have a vitamin C deficiency that need more of it, and do get sick. So I'm switching out for apple juice. I did drink orange juice earlier because just of all the stress and like being in an airport first time in a while, I figured, it's almost like conditioned into me now as well. It's like I should have a couple orange juice.
Yeah. So what you're saying earlier about I forgot exactly your comment, but kind of about like religion affecting like American war and stuff. How do you feel like that plays out like currently? Because I feel like we're kind of more of a secular society than we have been in the past. And even like our president still will mention God or whatever. But I feel like it's safe to say he's probably one of the more secular presidents we've had.
Yeah.
Like, how do you feel like that plays into like his personal war strategy or just in general? Like, if our society really is shifting to be more secular, how is that affecting our foreign policy?
I think Obama made an interesting statement in the beginning of his presidency that, I'm paraphrasing, but kind of went along the lines of, we're not just a Christian society anymore, we're a mixed group of people. And I think like atheism is kind of on the rise as well. A lot more people are into that now. And I think him as a whole, him just who he is as a president, is a big change for our country. Can't say that he's necessarily any different or he's doing anything better. Politics are very... I can't even say that presidents are doing anything for our country ever.
You really don't know.
No. For all I know, there's a real panel of people that are just behind the curtain who really pull the strings, and you gotta have a figurehead,
Right.
Someone who goes to meetings at the UN and talks to Russian warlords who wants to shoot warheads at us. You gotta have somebody to go, and you gotta have somebody that, I think it's so incredibly stupid for people to point at a single individual and go, it's his fault that we're broke and that you know, we don't have employment, and he's trying to, you know, take away rights and all this stuff. You know, the right's going to blame Obama for everything because they want power. They want to put their man in power. And when their man's in power, they're going to say they're doing everything right, and the Democrats are going to bash him. It's like... I mean, it's something that divides us more than it puts us together.
Yeah.
And going back to what you're saying about what where our country is, I think that the internet has given us an interesting perspective on our world, because now we're more interconnected than ever. We can see things all around the world and how they affect us. We're less and less looking at the world as something that has boundaries, you know, a wall of Mexico and a border of Canada, and it's like, really, that is just all stuff we're making up. There are no borders. The world is just one thing. It's just groups of people with power who go, this is my plot of land, and this is my plot of land, and don't come over here.
Right.
I'm going to roll it this way. But all that stuff, none of it exists in reality.
And it's becoming more arbitrary because of things like the internet and media expanding like our experience of these places, even though maybe it's not experience in the places, it's experience of media from the places. I agree.
And it's more prominent now that people around the world are seeing how other people live. Netflix documentaries are abound. They're incredible. You know, you can. It's easier to understand, connect on an emotional level with someone who lives in the Middle East and relate to them on an emotional level, and have less language gaps. Because it used to be language gaps would divide us, and we had to believe whatever the media was going to present to us. Meanwhile, you never see, like, the one thing that's in common, no matter if it's Republican, Democratic, Independent, any media, the one thing they all have in common is they're all American-based. You don't see Japanese media translated into English broadcasting to the U.S. people. You know, just like you don't see that in Japan or India or whatever. Everybody's going to have their point of view from their home base. And I mean, that's it goes back to politics. I mean, media funds presidencies. Presidencies keep those medias in power. They're corporations just as much as any business corporations are.
There's kind of a symbiotic relationship,
Exactly. So they survive on each other, and that's how the circle just keeps propagating itself, I think. It's just, you know.
Well, I think the thing that's interesting, though, is about the internet is that, like, the internet is also starting to play that game, you know, with, like, Google now, or a lot of search engines, or even Facebook. So there's so much, like, metadata or data even just personally about you that their search results reflect what you want. So it's almost like, the internet is expanding our like, experience of things, but it's also turning us more into ourselves, because if it just becomes a machine for feeding us more of what we like, it's actually doing the opposite.
Yeah.
So, I mean, even the internet is learning to play this game of, like, the symbiotic game of, like, giving people what they like. Because, I mean, that's what media channels do. I mean, Fox News plays a certain demographic, you know, MSNBC plays a certain demographic, and they do a good job, you know. But I think, you know, the internet is doing that, but for the individual, not for the demographic.
Yeah.
So, or even, like, Facebook, too, you know, that's a whole other...
I think the normal media of what we've talked about, the news, that's got to become a thing in the past. I think, you know, and that's another thing, like... A conversation like this that we're having right now is probably far more beneficial than what a lot of the continued recycled themes that get played on political stations, you know? And also the fact that they have a set structure of what they're going to say, how they're going to say it, why they're going to say it.
Right.
Because it's not like you have a news host who's... I mean, some stations you do, but for the majority of the major players, you've got your news host, and he's gonna say what the guy who's paying him to say.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, and if people only have that one angle, you know, and it's like, don't branch off into this, and don't talk, and if someone refutes you, someone comes on the show and refutes your point of view, well, you need to attack that person back, because this is our platform. We have to protect this platform.
Right, yeah.
Meanwhile, with an outlet like this, we can say whatever we want. Nobody's telling us what to say. we can, you know, I can produce this to be whatever I want. I don't have to edit. We can speak freely. Like, the language is not an issue.
Right.
We can go for as long as we want. And that's another thing. You have shows where you bring people on to have debates that last, like, 5 minutes. And it's like, what are you going to accomplish in 5 minutes? You know? Like, our political assistant isn't 5 minute chunks of information, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's all about selling a product, though, you know, no matter what it is. If it's on TV, it's informative, but it's still selling a product.
But it's like what you said, it's like people can choose to listen to things like this or whatever suits their tastes. Whatever, you know, they go out and they find things based on what other people all around the world have recommended or what they discover, and then they can subscribe to that, and they can listen to that and read blogs, read articles, you know, and it can go to independent people. People can literally manage entire platforms of information by themselves now, just through laptops, just through the internet. You know, you get on, you type up an article, or you do a podcast, you do something like that. A single individual can do it all themselves, and you don't have all this tug and pull from people that are paying the bills. There's not all this diffusion of responsibility that comes from giant corporations who all have to agree on one thing that's best for their platform, basically.
Yeah.
So I think we're in the most interesting time of information ever.
Yeah.
And it's crazy to think that it's only going to go further and further. It's just an issue of, will that technology save us or kill us?
Yeah, exactly.
Kill us all. So, because I've talked with friends about how, you know, I think it's going to get to a point where technology is going to be embedded in it. It's already happened. You know, we've got, you know, people have prosthetic legs, glass eyes. You know, this is old technology implemented into our bodies. Pacemakers, you know, just the idea of a pacemaker is bananas.
Yeah.
But
it's like, it's into transhumanism a little bit.
Right,
yeah.
Right. It's very matrixy.
Yeah.
But I think it's gonna get to a point where you look at iPhones, for example. It's like every year the chips in the iPhones and smartphones get smaller and smaller. But when the A1 processor came out, you know, it was like that big. It was very tiny. Well, I think that it's going to get to a point where technology is going to be on a cellular level. You know, I think that we're going to have microorganisms, microtechnology flowing through our bloodstream, monitoring our health, detecting infectious diseases as they arise. I think that we're going to have something in our brain where right now we have a question, we can just pull out our phone and we can Google it. I think it's going to get to the point where we're going to have something in our brain where we think a question and instantly the answer is given to us via the internet, via Google, whatever it is. I think that is not far away.
I don't think so either, yeah. Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't know.
That's the thing. It's like, when does a human cease to be a human? I mean, I don't know the answer to that. But just like, you know, when do we get to the point where so much technology affects us in such a way that we really lose touch with what it means to be human?
I don't know. In a way, it can be argued that it's already happening, but in another way, I mean, it could be argued that it's helping us immensely, you know? It goes both ways, totally.
Right.
And I guess you just have to wait for a couple, you know, it's happened so quickly, you know? I think maybe the 90s is a good indicator of, like, when it started. So in these 20 years, you know, we have phones in our pockets, we have computers in our pockets, you know, everywhere. The free flow of information, like I said, the interconnected of social media, you know, just all kinds of stuff. Google Glasses, people building noses on their foreheads, and, you know, just all kinds of stuff. I'm trying to think back of just all the crazy stories that I might have heard over the last 2 years. You know, I'm sure if we sat here and thought about it, we could think of so many things. Commercial space.
Just
commercial space flight. You know, you got Sir What's-His-Face. What's his name?
Yeah.
It starts with a B.
Bernard, I'll think of it. We talked about this recently. He owns the airline company.
Oh, yeah. It's something. And then he owns, like, it's something X or something, right? The space company?
Yeah.
X in the name or...
Oh, it's going to kill me. I'll think of it eventually. But, yeah, he started out doing, like, submarine tour. I mean, he's just filthy rich. But now he's, like, doing commercial flights to space and all this kind of stuff. So, I plan to go into outer space in zero G before I die, before my lifetime.
I think that's very possible.
Yeah, Mars is on the way, for sure. And
I saw something online about it. I think just last year they're recruiting people to train them for a Mars mission, like that supposedly will actually happen in like 10 years or something. They're starting training now, and I think they already selected like candidates or something, which is crazy. And maybe it won't actually happen, but they're like, you know, if you get selected, you get paid, and you for 3 years you spend training. Like I forgot.
You fly 18 years to get to Mars, you get paid, and then you use it all the great shopping malls they have there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, and I think it's like in the Netherlands or something, but it's some it's almost like it's a private enterprise thing though. It's like, you know, privately funded, but they're, you know, they're getting funds, but yeah, they're starting to train people for a mission, and they're going to send teams over there, so that's pretty crazy.
That is. I think volunteers are the way to go though. I think once you go out past that the moon spectrum, I think we're getting to the point where we can have, if the technology is good enough, I think we could send people with groups of people, train people that are government, you know, like NASA figures, real astronauts that know what they're doing, that can lead groups and stuff like that. You could probably, if you could establish a livable habitat, you know, you could probably bring regular folks up there and give it a shot. I mean, you know, I think the idea of traveling into space is so great for people that they're willing to risk it for themselves, you know.
Yeah.
I think people, you know, before we could even go to the moon, I'm sure people that are, you know, in their, you know, 70s and 80s right now, when they were kids, were thinking, you know, I would do anything to go to the moon. And I think that attitude is still there. I think, you know, space will never go away in terms of what the fascination it gives people. So I think, despite the spaceships, the Challenger, you know, blowing up, and just the mishaps that we've had with space, I think people will always be willing to go to space. Will it be shitty? Probably. I mean, if you're the first person to Mars, it's probably going to suck terribly. But man, what a view. What a view.
Yeah, that would be great.
And I mean, eventually, you know, then we'll just push farther. We'll go past that. But I always think of this, though, of how crazy it'll be. Because, you know, say people wanted to go to, like, there's some planets outside of our solar system that we've recently discovered that seem to have the same atmosphere as Earth. And I'm sure eventually we'll get to the point, you know, maybe 100, maybe 200 years from now, where we have the ability to send a spaceship to that planet. So it'll be really weird when we load up that spaceship and we send it off, and it's, let's say it takes 100 years to get there. There's these things called generation ships, and you load up, let's say a trip takes 500 years to go to this other Earth. You send a bunch of people, it's like a giant cruise line spaceship basically, and you send all these people, and those people have kids, and then their kids have kids, hence the generation ship. So basically the first couple generations possibly are going with the knowledge that they're not going to make it to the planet, you know, unless...
Well, and some generations may spend their whole lives on the spaceship.
Exactly. You know, like I said, the first couple generations may die on that ship unless they have technology to freeze themselves, or the medical technology is just out of this world. But it's going to be really wild if it gets to that, and there's this, you know, it's a 500 light year trip,
or 500-year trip, excuse me, and we send a spaceship to go, and they get halfway there, and then back on Earth, we develop, you know, it's been 250 years, and we've developed an even better, faster ship, and we send a ship that beats them there, and it's like, do you stop and pick up the people in that ship, or do you go to the planet and throw them a greeting party when they get there, and then they get there, and they're like, what the hell? We spent an extra 250 years to get here, and you guys have been here for 250 years before us. Like, we left way before you.
I feel like that sort of thing brings up all these sort of, sort of crazy possibilities. Like, will the people on the ship, like, cease to believe that Earth exists because they have no firsthand experience? Like, will they, like, remember their mission or, like, care at the mission because you lose, you know, touch and, you know, Earth becomes this place of lore? Like, how do they know anything outside of the spaceship exists? It's great potential for fiction, you know?
Yes, exactly. I was just thinking that.
Have you ever read Ender's Game?
Last flight that I did to Boulder. When I went to Boulder, I picked up Ender's Game in the airport.
Yeah.
A friend of mine, Alan, who's the one who lives in New York, he talked about his dad, I think. Or no, that was Dune. Have you ever read Dune?
I've never read Dune.
Dune's a really good book, but I think Alan recommended Ender's Game to me, but I saw it and picked it up, read it. It was one of my favorite books. Yeah. I really liked it.
They have a couple other ones, and one of them they deal with, like, I think he goes to another planet and then comes back, and he's, like, younger than the people on Earth because of the different, you know, space travel he's done. But they have a movie coming out, in November, so.
Yeah. Got to make movies out of everything now.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I'm reading a book right now called Never Cry Wolf, and it's about a Canadian biologist, true story, who goes to the Arctic to live with wolves for like a year or two by himself. And I just started it, but it's pretty interesting. So it's always nice to have a book on the flight. So that's the book I brought with me, and then I also bought a book on Buddhism, actually, as well. So. Yeah, thrift stores. You can find some crazy books in there. So
yeah, I'll show you. Since you said you minored in philosophy, I'll show you the book I got in a thrift store. I've been reading a little bit through, but
existentialism.
Just kind of introduction to existentialism.
How do you say his name again?
Dostoevsky.
Dostoevsky. He's Russian, right?
Yep, Russian. Yeah. Yeah, I actually really like Dostoevsky, which is part of the reason they got it. I was like, oh, it has one of his, you know, writings in it.
Yeah. Very cool.
So that's one of the things I've been reading on the trip out and the trip back, so yeah.
Very cool. Do you have some favorite books of all time that rank up there?
As far as fiction goes, Ender's Game is probably up there.
Yeah, it's a really good one.
As far as nonfiction, also fiction, Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. I read that not too long ago. But I'm not even done with it. The book, the nonfiction book that I'm reading and I'm really liking a lot. It's called Cost of Discipleship. It's by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was a minister in Germany during World War II, and he's part of the resistance. So he actually was executed a few days before the war ended. Really good stuff. He talks a lot about the Sermon on the Mount, especially as that's like Jesus' core teaching and stuff. But it talks a lot about like hardcore, like what does it mean to be like a disciple of Jesus, you know, really like outside of this. Because, you know, I feel like, you know, I'm a Christian, and like I feel like in our culture there is like, there's not only, probably secularization is not the worst enemy, I'd say, of the church. Really, apathy is, and there's a lot of apathy in his time, and a lot of the apathy was the church was complicit with the state of Germany, you know, committing all these atrocities, and he was really against that. And so, you know, I don't feel like we have as big of a battle, or, you know, maybe our government isn't committing, you know, that level of atrocities. I don't know, some people would say we are, but you know, the idea that there's if you become complacent in your religion, if I can use that word, if you become complacent in your worldview, you might become complicit to like things that are, you know, very bad. So Yeah, so it's a really good book. And yeah, he was a theologian, but he was also just pretty much a badass, like as far as just like the way he lived his life and the fact that, you know, he talks a lot in this book about like potentially giving up your life for what you believe, and you know, he eventually did that. So the fact that it wasn't like he had this life experience and then he wrote about it. He wrote about like what he believed and then he actually lived it out, which is pretty cool. So anyway,
yeah,
that's the other thing.
Yeah, I was raised Catholic. My family's pretty much all Catholic, and
is
I went
to big Catholic area. Or sorry. To
yeah. It's a, I mean the South is definitely the Bible Belt. So
yeah.
You know, Alabama and it's pretty much Baptist, Catholics, maybe some Protestants, stuff like that. And I went to a Catholic elementary school too. But I guess around 13 or something like that, I just like felt that I needed to like branch off.
Yeah.
Like I felt very spoon-fed in a way, and I just felt like kind of like what you were saying a little bit. You know, you don't want to narrow yourself down to one point of view. And also, kind of going back to what I was saying about religions can get taken and turned into political mechanisms in a lot of ways, and it kind of diverges from the actual religious message that a lot of religious organizations start out with originally. And so I kind of diverged from Catholicism for a good while just for the sake of trying to find out more, I guess. And of course, I mean, in college, I looked around and stuff. I feel like I could never possess enough confidence to say anything about what God or who God or if God,
yeah.
You know? And I think that you fall in a trap the minute you think that you know the answers. And I think that a lot of religious organizations have people that claim that they know the answers, and they hold rituals every weekend where, you know, you go in and it's like, you gotta do this, you need to do this, you gotta have this if you wanna go to heaven, hell,
yeah,
all this kind of stuff. And I just think that kind of mentality should be regarded with a bit of caution. But at the same time, once you have something that goes for hundreds of years and gets built up into this thing, it becomes almost like its own political system and stuff like that. Plus, people want answers, and since nobody can, in my opinion, can really give them completely, that freaks people out. People don't like death. People don't, you know, like knowing what purpose is or if there's purpose and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier for people to just have them given the answers, and so, you know, but it's those people who just take and just go with it that end up, you know, watching the news and going, oh, the Middle East they want to kill Christians and they don't want any of this stuff, which all that stuff gets loosely translated a lot of times, you know, and it's like,
yeah,
it's huge political ordeal. But you know, I feel like having learned a lot about Jesus from my childhood and all these kinds of things, I think that he was a dude who had it right. I think he was enlightened. I think he had all the right message. I think he understood love completely, which should be the backbone of any spiritual religion. I think it should be the backbone of anything in life. Love should be ultimate number one. And I think he knew that, and I think he was just a guy trying to teach people that. And I think, you know, once again, that freaked some people out and they killed him. And I think that all of the major religious and spiritual prophets of the world, whether it was the Buddha or the Muhammad, I think they were all like that to a degree. And then, you know, when you see someone who comes along like that, who's just on that level, you know, you treat them like gods, even though a lot of them claim that they weren't gods. Buddha didn't claim he was a god. And I'm not sure that Jesus claimed he was a god or something. Because, because there's different translations. Like, different religions that have different books regarding Jesus. And they're, you know, different. Because you got to think, you know, when when Jesus died, you know, the Bible just wasn't around. Like, it came after, and it became from other accounts, and then it...
It came from a lot of eyewitness accounts. And I mean, I understand that point, and but, I mean, if you read, like, what Jesus says, like, his claims of divinity are pretty interlaced. So, I'd argue against that point, but, you know, just because it is so interlaced with his message that, you might as well completely fabricate what he says if he had no claims to divinity. So I tend to think that, you know, he did claim that he to some divinity, but maybe he wasn't. Like, well, you know, I think then you make a choice, was he or was he not?
Right. What I think is, when I see quotes that, you know, he says, I'm the Son of God or stuff like that, or I am God, I totally 100% can believe that.
Yeah.
But I also 100% believe that he was trying to get the message across that we are all God, and that was like the thing, like he was trying, like we should all be God, we should all be sons of God.
Uh-huh.
Like that was his big thing. Like,
wouldn't
you
go out and say that though?
Huh?
Wouldn't he go out and say that though?
I think he did, and I think, but it's the degree of like how people afterwards took that and put it into writing, because you know, once those, you know, writings get circulated, like you got to think people hand wrote the Bible, and then like it would go overseas, and then people would write it elsewhere, and then people would go, well, I think he meant this, and I think it sounds more poetic this way.
Yeah.
And then you don't have copy machines and all this kind of stuff, and then hundreds of years goes by. You can hardly trust things that are present in the last 50 years with a lot of stuff, much less something that was 2000 or whatever.
Well, see, the thing is actually like, and I know this stuff because I'm just, you know, I know what I know, but like, you can go back pretty far. You can't go back to exactly Jesus' time. And a lot of the accounts were written, you know, 30, 40 years after. But they were written, like, either by eyewitness accounts, or, like, you know, people talk to eyewitnesses. So, and of course, there's, like, a little bit of loss of translation, people forget. But, you know, and then also, like, a lot of the early church fathers had access to, like, documents or just, you know, stories and things. So a lot of, like, the Gospels can be quoted by early church fathers writing messages back and forth. So I don't know. I feel like if we have a reason to believe anything, you know, like, we have probably a reason to believe that, you know, Jesus was similar to, you know, pretty close to what the Gospels say. And, like, I think, you know, I understand that people doubt that, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about that, too. But I think, like, there's more documentation on him than a lot of other people who we don't really doubt their, you know, their nature. And I think the reason we doubt his nature is just, you know, he's a controversial figure, for sure. And a lot of, you know, a lot of people who aren't Christian, like, still like his teaching, so they, you know, they want to appropriate some of that meaning too. So yeah, it's just controversial. I think that caused more doubt and controversy than...
Well, it's also another thing is like the fact that people adapt things to like suit them 100%. Like, you ever notice like Jesus is always like a white dude, like Mary's is always a white girl. It's like, well, they're from the Middle East, so, you know.
They would have had a big nose and black hair.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. So,
well, I think on that point, like, so you're talking about the suiting of things, and like, but see, like, Jesus' disciples, like, all of them died for, you know, martyrs, or at least we're told, and we have reason to believe a lot of them died, like, for, you know, persecution. I think, like, the idea that we're all gods is a lot easier to swallow than the idea that, like, this guy who was God was actually killed. And, like, you know, because they believed that he was going to be some military leader, like, literally, you know, the Messiah that is described in the Old Testament is establishing Israel as this eternal kingdom, and they thought he was going to be it. And so, this is a total surprise for them, you know, as far as how the Gospels were written of this guy, you know, all of a sudden, you know, this is what's supposed to happen. So I think, you know, I think there's, like, I think if it was more convenient for them to do something, they probably would have translated things more into, like, oh, we're all gods. But I think, so I don't know, I think for that reason, I mean, I don't know, Jesus is such a weird guy, and the Gospels are just so weird, like, that there's something self-authenticating to me, at least, about just the oddness and absurdity of it all, and just the idea that this, you know, this God that came down was a total, like, I don't know, totally blew everyone's expectations of what he's supposed to be. But maybe, you know, the claim is that he did something even, accomplished something even greater. So, I don't know, there's something, you know, absurd about that, you know, self-authenticating in a way.
Right. Yeah. I think that, first of all, I want to address that, like, the fact that, you know, the idea that, you know, of if he was God, or if he was the Son of God, or if, you know, in his message that we were all God. I think, you know, there's also a possibility that people may have written it a certain way to make him look like the one head. Because instead of saying that, like, you know, instead of broadcasting the message that we should all be trying to achieve what Jesus achieved, and to be totally pure and totally radiating of love to achieve God, to make him seem like he was the ultimate one thing, because it's sexier that way. You know, it's sexy to make Jesus.
I don't know.
I think so, because like they do with Muhammad, and it's just like, I mean, when you look into like even tiny like cultures of like Native Americans or stuff like that, a lot of people have one central figurehead that they like worship and glorify and all this stuff. But it's like all the messages also kind of intertwine. I feel and then going back to what you were saying about Jesus being somebody that did something more incredible, to the point where, like, you know, he sacrificed himself without batting an eye in the sake of God to like prove a point that this was a higher cause and stuff like that. And I just think he was on that level. I think he achieved a level of spirituality and mentality that is the ultimate level. But I also see that in elements of certain Eastern religions, like the famous monk who lit himself on fire to protest war or whatever it was.
Was it the Vietnam War, or is it?
I think so. I should know this.
I know the image.
Yeah. It was on the original Rage Against the Machine cover.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, people like that, you have to be on another, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Because, I mean, that's an intense way to go.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, crazy. The other claim that, like, okay, like, if this isn't true, then obviously Christianity is kind of like, well, yeah, that's not really as legit. Like, you know, is that he, like, you know, was raised from the dead, or he raised himself from the dead. I mean, even Paul, who, like, was kind of, in a way, the founder of Christianity, like, you know, as far as he wrote a lot of the New Testament, says that, you know, the resurrection didn't happen, that Christians are to be pitied more than anyone else, because they're putting their whole hope in this dude who just died, and, you know, that he wasn't much of a, yeah, wasn't much of a natural, like, I don't know, he was just kind of a humble guy who died, like, and why would you claim divinity on that? So, yeah, there's this, I think there's a certain gravitas to that, too, that, like, you know, if you don't believe that, then obviously, like, Christianity isn't as attractive.
Yeah.
Or not attractive even, but just, like, as worthwhile. I mean, yeah, because it's just another system of flaw. It's just another system of morality. But,
yeah.
And I think, you know, the other thing, like, I think, too, is the idea that the God, like, you know, came down, and that, you know, that happens somewhat in other religions too, the idea that God, like, initiates this contact, and that it's more about, like, what God does than what we do. And I think that's kind of fundamental to, you know, Christianity, and fundamental, it's, like, very tied into the way Jesus approached his ministry too. So, I don't know, I was just going on a tangent.
I think that a lot of the spiritual figures and the prophets that have been in our time, I feel like they all kind of embody, like, a certain, like, religion comes about from their existence, from their what they teach and what they preach and all these kinds of things, and people kind of take it and grow it because they want to spread it. I mean, that's the whole point, is they want that person's teachings to spread and go further and further. And even though I think there's a lot of different angles, and I think a lot of different beliefs that go through all these different religions, I feel like the message is always very, always the same almost. I feel like it's almost as if they were all books, that the author would be one central thing. And I think that's what the beauty of what God should be, what God is. And I think that all those guys were trying to preach that's what we should be working toward. And so for that reason, I think that they're all good things in a sense. I just, my problem is with people that take it and twist it, you know, mostly for reasons like for going to war,
right,
is my biggest gripe. But on the smaller levels of what religion is and what it means and all this kind of stuff.
Ooh. glass of ice.
I actually dropped my cup of ice on the last flight.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a thing. It's a thing.
Yeah, it is a thing. It's like, well, I don't know. Well, it was, as much stuff that I've had go wrong today, spilt ice, like, is not shit to me right now.
I'm in the cry over.
All right, man. Well, I guess we'll buckle up. Levi, you're a cool dude.
Yeah, and, you're two steps in.
Yeah, dude.
You need to come to Fort Collins.
I want to. You know, I really, like I said, I would love to come back to Colorado very soon. And like I said, I want to revisit Boulder. I'm sure I'll want to revisit Denver. And I want to see Fort Collins. I want to see all of Colorado. This is a great place. God's country is the nickname that I've heard.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. It's a beautiful place. And
it's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I'm going to sign off. Coastal Noise.
All right.